First of all, for giving me the chance to speak today. So I'm going to be talking mostly about a pair of papers with Alejandro Castro, who is here, and Nima Lashkari, that came out in the fall, the spring. And also, because this is an informal, relatively informal workshop, I'm going to mention at the end some work in progress with some subset of the power set of a list of authors that I have listed there, including some dot, dot, dots. That could be any of you. And as usual, I should warn you that the power set also includes the empty set. So take that as a bit of a warning. OK, so given the audience, I probably don't need too much of a general overview. So as we all know, the subject of quantum cosmology is a confusing one. Among the questions that we would like to answer are questions involving the consistency of cosmology and quantum mechanics. For example, is unitary quantum evolution consistent with inflation? Is it consistent with the existence of a Big Bang singularity? This is a subject that we already talked about a little bit this morning. I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask whether or not the rules of quantum mechanics need to be reconsidered in some way in cosmological settings. Today, I will focus on quantum gravity in an inflating spacetime. And among the questions that puzzle us when it comes to inflation are, what are the correct observables? What are we supposed to compute when it comes to quantum gravity in an inflating universe? And more sharply, I suppose, is the question of the entropy of a de Sitter or other cosmological horizon. Now, as most of us know, many rather similar questions were asked over the last several decades in the context of black hole physics and were answered by string theory and by the ADS-CFT correspondence. And so today, I would like to attempt to be bold and apply a similar set of techniques to cosmology. So the first lesson that I would like to draw from the ADS-CFT correspondence is that the wave function of the universe in the sense of Hartle and Hawking exists and in some cases is computable. So this wave function, if, for example, I want to consider some space-like slice through the universe with metric h, then you compute the wave function as a functional of h. And the Hartle-Hawking proposal is the statement that this wave function should be computed by performing a path integral in Euclidean signature, where I integrate over all geometries whose boundary is equal to h, weighted with some appropriate Euclidean action. Now, of course, in general, it's very difficult to make sense of an integral over a space of metrics. I think many of us believe that there's at least some sense in which quantum gravity can be thought of as a sum over geometries. But this is very difficult to make precise, except in the case of anti-de Sitter space, where this wave function can, if you think about it correctly, be regarded as the partition function of a conformal field theory.
Slice in ordinary global anti-de Sitter space?
No.
You do not.
I do not mean that. I mean,
so in anti-de Sitter space, what one actually regards as a wave function is a slice parallel to the boundary, where the radial direction is the quantity which is holographically reconstructed and gives you the CFT partition function up to some local counter terms. That is not what Hartle and Hawking would have called the wave function. So maybe I should put Hartle and Hawking in quotes here.
It is what Hartle and Hawking is. Hartle and Hawking is the sum of this and another one, which is the complex conjugate. But I think it is precisely what they...
In the Sitter space, but not in ADS, right?
It's also in ADS. Hartle and Hawking would have called it the Euclidean part of the wave function.
Yes. I think that
it's not the wave function that you take psi and multiply it by psi star to give you the probability.
Well, that's the usual objection. I mean,
no, that's not an objection.
The usual feature of the wave function It's sort of like a Klein-Gordon equation.
Yeah. I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to be cool. I'm just trying to get some clarity.
Yeah, yeah. So this is supposed to give you a wave function, which is like a Klein-Gordon wave function.
Right.
And in order to compute norms, you need to take phi d phi, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you take norms. And given the Klein-Gordon, what is really well defined is a non-relativistic approximation where you have, let's say, something that oscillates in time into the IM phi, and mm-hmm. you take positive frequencies, and
right.
then you get the Schrödinger wave function.
Right.
ADSFT is sort of like taking the Schrödinger wave function of that,
right.
of that thing.
Right.
So this thing right. evolves with ordinary time?
No, it's a Euclidean
converge. So it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's not the thing that either wave or function would have called a wave function.
It's actually I think it's a wave function in the sense of future probabilities. It is a wave function. It's what quantum mechanics is the output of the quantum theory. It's this wave function. So it's a probability for things to happen.
So after analytical continuation, it becomes a wave function, not before, right?
No, this equation is not the same.
This discussion is both fascinating and important, but not the discussion I wanted to have right now. So the point I think that I wanted to emphasize is that in anti-de-Sitter space, there's a rather precise way that one can make sense of expressions like integral over a space of metrics weighted by an action. And the question that I would like to try and address today is whether or not there are other circumstances, cosmological circumstances, where I can perform a similar sum over geometries. And then one can attempt to interpret that as the wave function of the universe in some sense. We'll return to that maybe at the end of this talk, and that might be a better time to have this interesting, important, but not desired discussion. Okay. So our goal is to try and find as simple a theory as possible, which nevertheless, so that we can actually attempt to compute a path integral of the sort that we're considering, but yet a theory which is complex enough to exhibit the features of cosmology that we're interested in trying to describe. So the theory that I'll consider today is three-dimensional general relativity with a positive cosmological constant. The action is the usual Einstein-Hilbert action. There are two dimensionful coupling constants. There's Newton's constant, which has dimensions of length in three dimensions. And there's a positive cosmological constant, 2 over L squared, where L is the curvature radius, which also has dimensions of length. And as we'll see, there's a very precise sense in which, in the present situation, we can compute the path integral as a sum over a space of metrics, exactly. And in performing this computation, I will be inspired, let's say, by bits and pieces of the ADS-CFT correspondence, but I will not use it. And so roughly half of my talk today is going to be devoted to the computation of this path integral, and the other half will be devoted to an attempt to interpret the results, and I'm sure the long and interesting discussion that we'll have when I try to do so. But before diving into any particulars of the computation, let me just describe to you the general idea of the computation of this path integral. So if one is starting to try and perform an integral over a space of quantum fields, for example, the first thing that one does is one starts with a saddle point approximation, where you, in the leading semi-classical approximation, write this path integral as a sum over classical saddles, solutions to the equations of motion, which I've called G naught here, weighted by the classical action, which I've called minus K times S naught. So here S is the Einstein-Hilbert action. Because there are two dimensionful quantities, there's only one dimensionless coupling constant in the theory, which you could take to be the curvature radius measured in Planck units. This is the quantity that plays the role of 1 over h bar and suppresses perturbative corrections of the theory. So in writing the classical piece, e to the minus k s naught, I've just extracted the k dependence, the coupling constant dependence, of the tree level piece. Now, if one is very powerful or very lucky, one can then proceed to compute
perturbative corrections around this classical saddle point answer. The usual way that one does this is by computing Feynman diagrams, which appear order by order in a power series in 1 over k as corrections to this classical answer. And the point is that to the extent that we know how to define path integrals in quantum field theory, the saddle point approximation will become an exact expression for the path integral, provided we can do two things. If we can find all of the classical solutions to the equations of motion, and if we can find the infinite series of perturbative corrections around each classical saddle. In most quantum field theories, this is not something that we would even attempt to do, because not only can we not compute the infinite set of Feynman diagrams around any given saddle, we also can't even find all of the solutions to the equations of motion. Yes?
What point two is going to work out in your example, but in an actual quantum field theory where there's generic structure, I mean, that's not really true. The second thing just gives a divergent series.
Well, it gives you a divergent series, which when you resum, including the sum over all classical saddles, will give you a finite answer. For the quantum field theories where we know how to do this, it works. Those are mostly, of course, topological quantum field theories. So, for example, in Chern-Simons theory, one can compute the partition function and show that it has precisely this form. And there's a reason why I'm bringing up the example of Chern-Simons theory, because, as many of you probably know, three-dimensional general relativity is very closely related to a Chern-Simons theory.
In theories where the loop expansion doesn't truncate, it's not that simple.
Yes, that's correct. But this is also a theory where the loop expansion truncates.
I know.
So when I say infinite series of perturbative corrections, I'm being a little snide, because actually most of the terms in that infinite series are zero. But it makes it sound much more impressive. Now, how is it that I'm going to be able to perform both of these computations? Well, I'm working with three-dimensional general relativity, which is a theory with no local degrees of freedom, which means if I want to find all of the classical saddles, all I need to do is go to the Wikipedia page on spherical three manifolds, and they're all listed there. The classification of the solution of Einstein's equations in three dimensions is essentially a group theoretic problem. And in the present case, it is a problem that's very similar to the classification of the crystallographic point groups in three dimensions. And, as we already discussed, the computation of the perturbative corrections will be done by using an auxiliary formulation of three-dimensional gravity as a Chern-Simons theory. And one interesting point that I would like to emphasize is that the novel classical saddles that I'll be studying today actually have a rather straightforward physical interpretation. And it's one that I think is worth emphasizing because it leads to an interesting set of quantum gravity effects for observers living in de Sitter space. So my plan for today is first to find the classical solutions that I'm going to sum over, then to perform the sum, including all the quantum corrections, and then describe the results. Any other questions before I continue? Okay. So let me begin by reminding you of something that most of you already know quite well. So if we wish to consider the physics of a single observer in de Sitter space, then that observer has a causal access only to a small portion of the de Sitter geometry. It's the portion known as the static patch, which is given by this wedge or diamond-shaped region over here on the left-hand side of this diagram. So if I have an observer who's sitting at r equals 0, then that observer will see a cosmological horizon at r equals pi over 2 in these coordinates. And the metric in this coordinate patch can be written in a very simple form. It's just dr squared minus cosine squared r dt squared,
plus sine squared r d phi squared. T and phi are time-like and space-like coordinates in this causal patch, but of course they do not remain time-like and space-like if you were to continue these coordinates outside of the causal patch. So if one wishes to study, for example, quantum field theory in De Sitter space, then in fact, even at the level of free quantum field theory, there are some subtleties that arise. These subtleties arise because there's no global notion of conserved energy in De Sitter space, simply because there's no global time-like Killing vector. However, there is a notion of energy associated with any given observer in De Sitter space. For example, if you look at the metric on the causal patch associated to this observer sitting at r equals 0 here, this metric has a time translation symmetry and a rotation symmetry generated by the vectors d by dt and d by d phi, which define an energy and an angular momentum associated with this patch of De Sitter space. States, then, can be labeled by an energy and an angular momentum. And these energy and angular momentum operators will, these energy and angular momentum generators will then become charges which operate on, for example, the Fock space of a quantum field theory in De Sitter space in this causal patch. Now, in order to define the Hartle-Hawking state or any other quantum state in De Sitter space, we should describe it, if we want to study the physics of a single causal observer, in terms of these charges H and J. So the standard construction of a quantum state for field theory in De Sitter space is found by Wick rotating. So you take T to IT, and you obtain the Euclidean metric that I've drawn up above, dr squared plus cosine squared r dt squared plus sine squared r d phi squared. And as many of you already know, this metric will have a conical singularity at the horizon, r equals pi over 2, unless we periodically identify the Euclidean time coordinate. Once we make this periodic identification in order to obtain a smooth Euclidean geometry, we have the three-sphere S3, albeit written in coordinates that are less familiar than the usual coordinates that we use on the three-sphere. In order to understand the physical interpretation of this identification, we note that if we want to interpret this identification of the Euclidean time coordinate in terms of the operators H and J that I wrote down on the previous transparency, then the identification is generated by the operator e to the minus beta h, where beta here is equal to 2 pi. I'm using units where everything is equal to 1 except 2 pi. So L is equal to 1. So there's secretly a factor of the De Sitter radius L in this expression for beta. And we recognize rho as the density matrix that defines a canonical ensemble at finite temperature beta inverse, which is 1 over 2 pi L. So this, then, is the statement that we're all familiar with, which is the statement that the horizon of De Sitter space will emit a bath of radiation at the Hawking temperature 1 over beta. So I haven't so far told anyone here anything that they didn't probably already know. However, the important point is that if we are considering the physics in the causal patch of De Sitter space, then this is not the only metric that I could mean when I write down, when I say the words, the Euclidean continuation of De Sitter space. So when I was a graduate student, I was taught that the three-sphere is the analytic continuation of De Sitter space. I was probably taught that by some people in this room. But in fact, that statement needs to be slightly modified in this context. The correct statement is that the three-sphere is a analytic continuation of De Sitter space, and that if you're only thinking about the static patch of De Sitter space, there are, in fact, an infinite number of equally legitimate Euclidean geometries that could be called the Euclidean continuation of De Sitter space. To see why that is, let's just look at this formula here. So, in fact, it turns out that So in order for the geometry to be smooth at r equals pi over 2, the Euclidean time coordinate needs to be periodically identified. And, however, the identification that I wrote down on the previous slide, which gives you the three-sphere, is only one possible choice of identification which accomplishes this. I could also choose any other integer p and another integer q, which is coprime to p, and I could take t to be periodic with period 2 pi over p, along with a rotation by an angle q in the phi direction. And as long as the integers q and p are coprime, then this geometry is completely smooth, and it gives you not the three-sphere, but the Lenz space, which is a quotient of the three-sphere by Zp. The geometry does depend on q. For example, the topology will depend on q.
Using the way the group is embedded depends on
exactly. Exactly. So the isometry group of S3 is SU2 times SU2. There are many different ways of embedding ZP into SU2 times SU2. The number of different ways is the number of integers mod p coprime to p. Yes.
Difference if you're relating one solution or the other. I would think you would think of
yes.
Spinning.
Yes, that is exactly where we are going.
So why would you then add two different variables?
Okay, let me continue. Let's continue. Okay.
So this is specific to three.
This is specific to three. If you want to think about these as analogous solutions in four dimensions, you could think about the Nari-I geometry. This is a little bit like an infinite class of generalizations of the Nari-I geometry.
Nari-I geometry means a black hole with maximum lens?
Yes. So that analogy is not a particularly good one, but you could think of it that way if you like. These are the de Sitter analogs of the BTZ black holes. But in Euclidean signature, it turns out there are completely smooth solutions that you can construct, just like the SL2Z family of Euclidean BTZ black holes that Juan and Andy described are completely smooth in Euclidean signatures.
Wait, are they like states or are they like instantons?
They're instantons.
Right, so you have to symbol. They're not like...
Yeah, let's... They're instantons.
And that's why...
So that...
But they glue onto different...
No, they all glue onto this causal patch of de Sitter space.
But with a different...
Yes. So maybe I can.
You guys haven't discussed this.
I haven't given it before you. Before you disagree with my physical let me give you something to disagree with. Okay, good. So if we remember the physical interpretation of the three sphere was given a physical interpretation by finding the operator which generates the identification t to t plus 2 pi. Which was the operator e to the minus beta h, e to the beta h. Now we have a similar identification, which involves a rotation as well as a time translation. So that means that the identification is generated by an operator e to the minus beta h plus theta j, where beta now describes a temperature that is higher than the usual de Sitter temperature, and theta is a complex number, as it should be, because J is integrally quantized, and this should be some phase. What this means is that if you were to look at correlation functions in the Lenz space geometry, then you would interpret them not as field theory correlation functions at finite temperature and canonical ensemble, but rather as field theory correlation functions in grand canonical ensemble at finite temperature and finite angular potential. Or chemical potential, where theta here is going to be the chemical potential or angular potential conjugate to the operator J. We have two charges H and J in the static patch, and there are two thermodynamic potentials that one can introduce which are conjugate to them. So that means that the physics, as was anticipated, of an observer in a Lenz space is different from the physics of an observer in the sphere. The Hawking radiation will now contain correlations which were not present in the original three-sphere geometry. Now, from the point of view of quantum field theory in a fixed De Sitter background, all of these are equally good geometries that are deserving of the name Euclidean continuations of the causal patch of De Sitter space. So if I were simply studying quantum field theory in a fixed De Sitter background, I would then have to ask the question, which one of these geometries is the right geometry in some sense for me to use? But because I'm thinking of gravity, the answer is not which one should I use. The answer is because I should use all of them. Yes. They're not fully De Sitter invariant. Actually, let me. That's right. It breaks. So there's one of them, which is RP3, which actually has the full De Sitter isometry. But the other ones have some discrete breaking of the De Sitter isometries. Yes?
So in gauge theory, the thing that tells you up to some over instantons is a failure of the proposition if you don't. In ADS, the thing that tells you have to sum over these handle bodies or whatever is the failure of modular invariance.
Yes, that's where I'm going with this.
I was going to ask what tells you here. I mean, there's
okay.
No boundary, so
that's where I'm going. Okay, that's where I'm going.
Okay.
So let's not get ahead.
You will answer.
I'll give an answer. I can't promise you'll like it. Okay. Okay, so each geometry will contribute to the partition function. Now, so then the question is, why was I, when I was a graduate student, taught that the three spheres is the right geometry to use when you analytically continue from Lorentzian to Euclidean signature? And the answer is that each one of these geometries should, in the semi-classical limit, be weighted by their action, which is just the volume of the corresponding Euclidean geometry. Now, all of the geometries I'm talking about are smooth quotients of the three-sphere. So the three-sphere is the one with largest geometry, so it's the one that dominates the partition function. So in the semi-classical limit, everything is the usual story where I have exactly thermal Hawking radiation. But in the the limit where I keep finite quantum corrections, I'll have corrections to this standard thermal behavior coming from these other geometries.
Right.
It's the biggest volume.
Why doesn't that make it the smallest?
Well, it depends. So there's always the k is positive. So I've put minus. I've hopefully yes. So.
The action, did I get my minus signs? I got my minus signs right.
Right?
Okay. So in p is equal to 1,
wait.
Oh, this is what happens when you write your talk in the car on the way to the Perimeter Institute. Okay. There's a plus sign here. There's a plus sign here. Yeah, okay. Sorry about that. Okay. Maybe I'll correct that before they put this online. Okay, yes, so the sphere dominates because the action is e to the k times the volume. So the contribution of the partition function is e to the k times the volume. So the sphere, which is the p equals 1 guy, will dominate in the semi-classical limit. But the other geometries will give corrections, exponentially suppressed corrections, but corrections to the standard thermal behavior in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. Okay. In fact, for those of you who studied the black hole fairy tale and ADS3 quantum gravity, the story here is really quite similar. I'm going to get to that. No, but you have to do the right sum. Okay, you're doing the sum of the classical piece, but it would just be the wrong thing to do to sum only the classical terms without including the quantum corrections. The quantum corrections, okay, yes, it would be the wrong. So yes, if the naive sum diverges, but one has to also do the quantum corrections in order to decide whether the partition function diverges. Okay, and I don't steal my thunder. Okay, by guessing the answer. Okay, maybe for the paper, but that's unlikely. So
Okay, so for those of us who've studied ADS3 quantum gravity, the geometric structure that's appearing here is actually quite familiar. So in ADS3 gravity, if one wishes to compute the torus partition function of the theory, then you imagine that your boundary is a torus, and then you sum over all three-dimensional geometries whose boundary is a torus. Now, when you draw an abstract torus, there's no preferred cycle that you're singling out in an abstract torus. But when I draw a solid donut like this, a solid three-dimensional geometry, I'm singling out one cycle, which is going to be contractible in the interior. That's why when you sum over geometries in ADS3 gravity, you actually sum, even though ADS3 gravity is locally trivial, over an infinite number of geometries. And this is very similar to what's happening here. So in this case, we're summing not over all ways of contracting a cycle in the interior of the geometry, in the interior of an ADS geometry, but instead we're summing over all ways of contracting a cycle at the Euclidean horizon of De Sitter space. In particular, if you actually look at how these lens spaces are constructed, these lens spaces are constructed by taking two solid donuts and gluing them together on their boundary. And when you glue together the boundaries of two solid donuts, you're gluing together two toruses. So you need to choose an element of the mapping class group, SL2Z, which tells you how to glue them together. So, for example, if I take this gluing where I take this cycle, the contractible cycle into the non-contractible one, that just gives you the usual three-sphere. But these more complicated lens spaces are now just visualized as more complicated gluings where the Euclidean, contractible cycle at the in the neighborhood of the observer is then glued on to some more complicated cycle in the neighborhood of the horizon. So it's exactly the same modular group that you sum over when you sum over geometries in the black hole fairy tale. Okay.
You're only fixed geometry at the horizon, and summing over ways of filling it in?
I'm summing over all geometries, and I'm just pointing out that if you want to artificially divide the geometry into a part near the horizon and a part near the observer, then it has a very similar physical interpretation to that of the black hole fairy tale.
Is the horizon the torus?
A neighborhood of the horizon is a solid donut, and a neighborhood of our observer in Euclidean signature is also a solid donut. But different cycles are contractible, depending on how you glue them together. Maybe I don't want to get too into the geometry. I don't want to get too into three-dimensional geometry. I mean, that's not.
I'm just confused.
Yes.
De Sitter spaces, DS3, I mean, horizon should be one-dimensional. Wait for it.
The horizon is one-dimensional. It's a circle. It's the circle, so there's one circle which is at the sort of interior, I don't know how to describe it, sort of the meridian of the solid donut. So the solid donut is a thickening of the one-dimensional circle, which is the Euclidean horizon.
You only see one side of the horizon.
Yes.
So how do you see? I mean, how do you see the whole neighborhood?
I guess I'm not.
There's only one side of the horizon.
Yeah.
Right.
There's an angular direction that one has to. If you just think about the Penrose diagram, you'll get a little confused because you won't see the angular direction.
Oh.
Okay. So let's. Yes.
For the Hartle-Hawking wave function, you have to cut the Euclidean geometry sort of in half, and sort of here you're solving
okay.
Things.
Yeah.
I got lost
so
in how
let
you
me
know.
Tell you. Okay. In the actual computation that I'm going to do, I'm not going to compute the Hartle-Hawking wave function itself.
That's only the expectation.
Which. Well, I'm not even going to compute the expectation value. I'm going to compute the norm of the Hartle-Hawking wave function. That's the simplest thing for me to compute. We could also discuss computations of expectation values. They're not that much harder. But for the time being, I'm just going to focus on one computation. Okay. So I've spent enough time talking about the computation, so let's do the computation. So what I would like to do is compute the norm of this Hartle-Hawking state, which then will be an integral over all three manifolds without boundary.
So if I wanted to compute the components of the Hartle-Hawking wave function, I would need to introduce a boundary. That is actually a significantly more difficult computation, although we can discuss that. What I would like to do now is just compute the norm. Now, the first objection one might have to the computation that I'm doing here is that, as was already mentioned, if I do the sum over geometries just including the tree-level classical action, in fact, that sum diverges. And one might think that because three-dimensional gravity is a theory with no local degrees of freedom, there are no possible quantum corrections which would cure that divergence. In fact, however, this is not quite true. Even though there are no local degrees of freedom, there are no local fluctuations of the metric, there are still global degrees of freedom, which, if you wanted to think about it, you could say are associated with the topology of space-time. For example, in three-dimensional gravity with a negative cosmological constant, there are no local degrees of freedom, but there are still so-called boundary graviton degrees of freedom, which will contribute to functional determinants and indeed are absolutely necessary in order to get the details of the ADS-CFT correspondence to work out. So one can check quite explicitly that there are still quantum corrections in the theory. For example, you could calculate a one-loop determinant, and you could check that although the local pieces of the ghost and graviton determinants cancel, there's still a small piece left over. And it's this small piece that we need to compute in order to ask whether the sum over geometries is finite. There are zero-mode degrees of freedom, but there are other things as well. And in fact, the zero modes are the really tricky ones. Okay. Now, in order to determine these quantum corrections, yes?
I thought the geometries didn't have any.
The sphere and I think RP3 have zero modes. The other ones don't have zero modes.
No, they do. There's two Killing vectors.
Oh, yeah, sorry. There's still two. Yeah. Okay. There's still a general Lens space still preserves two Killing vectors, H and J.
Oh, but these are just gauge transformations. They are not physical zero.
That's right. They're not physical zero modes. But you need to worry about them when you do the whole gauge fixing Fadea pop-up procedure. And in fact, most of the hair that was pulled out when we did this calculation involved only the zero modes and conformal Killing vectors and all of that stuff. I don't have too much hair left, so I don't want to repeat that calculation in real time. Okay, so to determine these quantum corrections, we certainly don't want to try and compute the all-loop Feynman diagrams in three-dimensional gravity. Instead, we want to cheat. So how am I going to cheat? Well, classically, at least, three-dimensional gravity is equivalent to a Chern-Simons theory. It was observed a long time ago by Witten and others that the Einstein-Hilbert action can, at the classical level, be written as that of a Chern-Simons theory. And if I'm studying three-dimensional gravity in Euclidean signature, then the appropriate gauge group is SO4, or which is locally up to some global piece equal to SU2 times SU2. So one could then attempt to compute the partition function of gravity by using the fact that one can compute the partition function of a Chern-Simons theory using methods of topological quantum field theory. Now, this is a little bit of a delicate subject in Minkowski and ADS space, because in that case, the relevant gauge group is non-compact, and also one is usually considering spacetimes that are not compact as well. In the ADS case, for example, you're considering either an SL2R times SL2R or an SL2C Chern-Simons gauge theory, depending on what signature you're working in. And because both the gauge group and spacetime are not compact, the interpretation of the computation and the interpretation of this Chern-Simons theory is rather subtle. But we are in a uniquely lucky situation where we're considering a Chern-Simons theory with a compact gauge group on a compact manifold. So you can just compute this Chern-Simons partition function. The hard part is not computing that, because it was done a long time ago,
The hard part is interpreting it in a gravitational language. Because the important point is that although Chern-Simons theory and general relativity agree at the level of the classical equations of motion, there's no reason to expect that they're equivalent exactly at the level of the quantum path integral. For example, the path integral, the partition function of Chern-Simons theory, is a sum over all flat connections, all solutions of the equations of motion of Chern-Simons theory on a manifold of fixed topology. Whereas, as we've seen, in general relativity, the right thing to do is to sum over topologies. But instead of summing over all flat connections on a given topology, you just have one flat connection, which comes from the round metric on whatever space you're considering for that topology. But the claim is that even though these two theories are different at the level of the full path integral, they should be equal at all orders in perturbation theory around a given classical saddle. And this is actually a statement that can be checked.
You don't sum over metrics.
You do sum over metrics,
but every time you change the metric, you also change the topology. Not perturbatively.
Even around a given saddle point, there are local fluctuations that you're summing.
Yeah, okay. No, but when I say sum, sorry. When I say sum here, I'm talking only about the tree level sum. When I say we sum over one flat connection per topology, I'm saying there's one classical solution to the equations of motion per topology. In principle, there could be more, but in the present case, there happens to be only one. Let me say it a little more specifically. For the lens spaces, there are, in fact, a finite number of flat connections, SU2 flat, SU2 times SU2 connections on a lens space. One of them gives you, if you go through the gravity Chern-Simons theory map, one of them gives you the usual Einstein metric that we wrote down before, and all the others don't. They give you non-invertible metrics. One of them, for example, is the trivial solution where A is equal to 0 and the metric is equal to 0. That's not something that, as far as we understand, should be included in the path integral of gravity. Okay. So the hard part is not computing the Chern-Simons partition function. The hard part is extracting the information we want from it. We need to identify the correct saddle and extract the perturbative series around that saddle. And in fact, a lot of the hard work went into checking that, in fact, not only the tree-level piece, but the one-loop piece that you extract from this Chern-Simons answer agrees with that one would obtain simply by calculating the appropriate one-loop determinants in general relativity. Okay, so without any further ado, what's the answer? Well, the answer is that for three-dimensional Einstein gravity, even when you include the perturbative corrections, you still find a divergence coming from the sum over geometries. And this divergence arises because of the geometries whose volume is small or of order 1 in Planck units. And I've chosen a particular fancy way of writing infinity here. I've written it as zeta of 1 in order to emphasize that this is a divergence that can't be regulated using any of the standard field theory techniques. If you have a different contour you would like to propose, I would be all ears. I actually think that's an excellent question. The contour that I have chosen is, to my mind, the natural one, where we sum over all real metrics in Euclidean signature. But there are other possible contours one could choose.
That one diverges because of the conformal factor.
The conformal factor I'm dealing with in the usual way, where I'm rotating the conformal factor by 90 degrees, it gives you, so it turns the wrong sign Gaussian into the right sign Gaussian. This divergence comes from, this divergence is actually a divergence that you also see in the black hole fairy tale. It's why the authors of the original black hole fairy tale paper introduced what they called the fairy tale transform. The point is that all of the tricks that seem to work in the black hole fairy tale case Now fail when you apply them to Einstein gravity.
Alex, for a negative cosmological constant for Einstein gravity, I bet you also get the wrong answer if you just sum over that analogous set of cells of real metrics, and you have to sum over complex metrics to get a regular invariant.
There are different ways of getting the right answer. That's one way of getting the right answer. I'm also going to do the analog of a different way of getting the right answer, which is to consider the De Sitter version of topologically massive gravity or chiral gravity. So let me continue because I'm short on time. So what does this all mean? So one possibility is that either De Sitter gravity does not exist,
or that De Sitter gravity exists, but we have not done the correct path integral. I think a more reasonable alternative is that De Sitter gravity exists, but we are simply not computing the right thing. So the norm of the Hartle-Hawking wave function is not an observable quantity. So perhaps we shouldn't worry that it's not finite. But I think an even more likely possibility, and a possibility that we'll see is true on the next transparency, is that De Sitter gravity exists, or rather that the Hartle-Hawking wave function is normalizable only if we include more interesting degrees of freedom in addition to those of pure gravity. Well, because by De Sitter gravity, one doesn't necessarily mean pure Einstein De Sitter gravity. So for example, if I do the simplest modification to Einstein gravity that I can think of, which is to include an additional interaction term, which is the gravitational Trin-Simons term, then the theory now has a local degree of freedom. But it turns out that a large part of the computation that I did for you already carries through relatively unmodified. And what happens is that now, because I've added a gravitational Trin-Simons term, my Euclidean action is no longer real. My solutions are real. But as usual, because you have a Trin-Simons theory with a parity non-invariant Lagrangian, my action has a phase. And so when you do the sum over geometry, if you set things up correctly, you can get those phases to lead to cancellations. Just like the sum of 1 over p diverges, but the sum of minus 1 to the p times 1 over p does not. And indeed, that's precisely what happens. So the interpretation that I would give to this is that the Hartle-Hawking state is normalizable only when additional degrees of freedom, in addition to those of pure Einstein gravity, is added. So I'm probably out of time, but I'm not going to let that stop me. So I'd like to end just with a few minutes of speculation. So one of my motivations for this, considering these things that I described today, was the derivation of De Sitter entropy using the proposed DSCFT correspondence. So one way of interpreting this correspondence is the statement that the wave function, the Hartle-Hawking wave function, should approach the partition function of a conformal field theory as you approach future infinity. And if one considers a conformal field theory on a torus and uses modular invariants along with certain, in this case, not particularly well-justified assumptions, then one can show, one can reproduce the entropy of De Sitter space using Carty's formula. This is all on the gravity side. I am not going to say anything about the CFT today because I don't know much about the CFT today, but maybe tomorrow we'll know more. So the question that we would like to ask is, what is the origin of this modular invariance that we use to derive the De Sitter entropy via Carty's formula? In the ADS case, we knew how to answer that question. The SL2Z modular invariance arose because there's an SL2Z family of solutions to the equations of motion, which are all related by coordinate transformations. And so the general coordinate invariance of gravity in anti-De Sitter space
was responsible for the modular invariance of the boundary CFT. And as Alejandra will tell us tomorrow, in the presence of, she may tell us tomorrow. In the presence of a boundary, in fact, our saddle points are likewise related by large coordinate transformations. This group of coordinate transformations is the modular group.
And so the interpretation is that this is the origin of the modular invariance of DSCFT. So I'm really out of time, but I'm still not going to let that stop me. So I would like to end. So far, everything that I've said today is rather staid and boring. So I'd really like to end today with some speculations. So I've talked a lot about the wave function of the universe, but I haven't computed it for you. I haven't even told you any of its features. So near future infinity, the wave function should approach that of a conformal field theory. But at least with some choice of the normalization of the stress tensor, it's a conformal field theory with negative central charge. So it should have the opposite features from those that we're used to dealing with when we talk about two-dimensional conformal field theories.
With has an imaginary central charge.
Yeah, actually, well, I said with some appropriate choice of normalization of the stress tensor, which I'm not going to specify. Okay, the speculation then would be that unlike the case of standard two-dimensional conformal field theories, where the partition function diverges when your geometry is very inhomogeneous, here the wave function may vanish when the geometry is very inhomogeneous, and it might have peaks when the geometry is homogeneous. And the only special points on the moduli space of Riemann surfaces that I can think of are those places which are the places where the Riemann surface would have symmetries. And so if the wave function is finite, if it vanishes out of the boundaries, then it should be peaked at those special points. And if that were the case, then the wave function of the universe might prefer points with symmetry. And a talk on quantum cosmology would not be complete if I did not attempt to explain the cosmological constant problem. So, in fact, although I've not emphasized it, in the computation that I did, the partition function of the sitter gravity was a function of the coupling constants of the theory, and in particular, it's a function of the cosmological constant. And that partition function was finite only when the cosmological constant solved a certain number theoretic equation. It was an equation with no solutions in the Einstein gravity case, and it was a rather simple equation in the case of topologically massive gravity. But one could speculate that for more realistic theories of gravity, the sort of number theoretic constraint that the cosmological constant would satisfy could be more complicated. And this could perhaps explain its small value. So why don't I stop there? Thank you.